accession number 20939, Reel 4.
Alec Clark, Reel 4.
So, on this voyage, we went to St John, New Brunswick, and I can't remember the nature of the cargo, but obviously it was supplies of some kind for the United Kingdom. And I went there more than once to St John, New Brunswick. It was a nice little seafaring township, and I quite enjoyed my visit there. And as a matter of fact, from there, when I was in New York earlier on, we used to get free shows to the cinema and the theatre. There was a lady I met there, Mary Alden Perkins. She's from Charleston, New Hampshire. And I wrote to her for a while, quite a long time. And I got permission to visit her parents from St. John, New Brunswick. So I got permission to leave the ship. So I went across into the States and visited this lady's parents. She was, I think she was an only daughter. I think she was, yeah. And so I spent a weekend. So I just went to this home, and they made me welcome. And I went to church with them, and I just stayed the weekend. And Monday morning I went back to the ship again. And that was a lady friend that I met, but nothing came of it in the end because our ways parted, separated. But I always remember visiting this elder, well, this couple. And I think Mary, she was working in an office in New York, and I took her to a number of shows, theatre shows, took her to the Ice Follies 1944. We got these, I got the tickets freely so we could share them with somebody who gave us a bit of company, Mary Alden Perkins.
And then?
Now the Fort Capot River. Now, the next one, that was the Sam Constant, wasn't it?
Well, Empire Bardolph.
Oh, sorry. Oh, yes. Now, I don't remember a lot about the Empire Bardolph, apart from the where the voyages were to and from. But I do remember sailing across the Atlantic from America to Freetown. Now, I don't know if we took any cargo there or not, but I know that when we went to Freetown, we went to a special wharf to load iron ore. And of course, iron ore is just like liquid mud. They pour this stuff into the ship's hold, and it's very, very heavy, so they don't need a lot of it. And so we loaded up this cargo of iron ore, and I enjoyed my time ashore, you know, in Freetown. There wasn't much there. We loaded up the iron ore, and then we left for the UK. And that was a time when the stowaways came up to the stokehold, eight of them. So, but I don't remember a lot about the Empire Bardolph, really, except this voyage across the Atlantic to Freetown, and one or two things of that sort. I don't remember much more about it.
And then your last one, I think, was SS Sam Constant.
Yes, that was an American Liberty ship. That was the only one that Liberty ship. They were built in America during the war. They were called Liberty ships. They were built quickly. They were built to beat the U-boat menace. And that was a very interesting ship. I know. And then I was the only operator again. There was just the one operator by this time. I was a senior operator. And once the war had finished in Europe, they went back to just have one operator on watch. And so, now this voyage, that last voyage, there again, I don't remember much about what we did or what we didn't do, but I know we went to the Mediterranean, and we were going to Haifa to load a cargo. I think it must have been oranges in Haifa. But of course, Palestine was a very dangerous state at that time. The Israelis were just coming in. And Anyway, we weren't allowed ashore there because there was some forms of illness. I can't remember what kind of illness there was, but whether it was black, some kind of fever. But there was trouble ashore, fighting of different kinds, different groups of people were fighting. And, of course, the ship was empty. And it was a gales of wind. It was most uncomfortable on that Sam concert because the ship was empty. And it was pitching and tossing. It reminded me of the Herring Drifters. And I wasn't seasick, but I nearly was on the Sam concert. So we couldn't go ashore at Haifa. So I never landed in Israel. We went instead to Alexandria in Egypt. And from Alexandria, we loaded scrap iron and onions. All the tanks and all the debris of the war, all the metal was gathered together, and we had a whole ship of scrap iron and metal of all kinds was taken back to the UK. And that was my last voyage, was scrap iron and onions back to Newcastle, where I paid off my ship.
Did this Liberty ship show signs of having been built quickly?
No, not really. No, you wouldn't. No, they were very well built, very comfy ships, very good ships. Lovely big wireless room. I even had a typewriter, which none of the other ships had a typewriter. And I remember I hadn't used a typewriter up to this time. I thought, well, I'll try and get familiar with the use of the typewriter. But the captain used to have a sleep in the afternoon. He always have his nap. And he come up to me one afternoon and says, Sparks, are you typing your so-and-so biography? So I took the hint, and I didn't do any practice on the typewriter in the afternoons after that, because the wireless room was close by to the captain's cabin, you see. Captain and the wireless operator were always on the same level for convenience. But it was a comfy ship. And it was a good ship, too, because it was modern, you see. And, it was a very good ship, Sam Constant. They were well built.
What was discipline like in the merchant ships in your day?
That's a good question, because I can remember, was it the Sam Constant? Oh, it might have been. I remember one of the stewards. The officers had a steward to look after them, make the bed and give them a cup of tea and call them in the morning and all that sort of thing. And this steward, when he was at sea, he couldn't have done enough for you. But when he got into port, he got on a drink. And he had to be locked up sometimes because he couldn't, he didn't seem to control his faculties when it came to the drink. And it was a nice, see, you couldn't have got a nicer chap, but oh, when he was ashore and he got the drink in, oh, he was, he was worse than anything. But I can't think of any trouble of any kind, except that, on the Ball Trader, when I think of the captain, he didn't get any money. He wasn't given any money. He couldn't give any pesetas to the men, and they sold ship stores, but nothing ever came of it. No one could charge them or fine them or... They got away with it because nobody could do anything about it. So most ships, the captain, it was the captain's job to see that the ship was run well. And I always had a high regard for the captain because they were in charge. It was their ship, and most of them did their job very well. And I think that discipline was pretty good. Sometimes you had a British crew, sometimes, like on the city boats, you had Indian crew. But they all seemed to pull together pretty well. And
you were saying that these Empire ships came under the government?
Oh, yes. Yeah, well, the Empire diplomat, yes. They were that one. But not them all. The government only commandeered ships that they wanted. And, of course, they needed oil rig. They needed oil depot ships to supply the destroyers and the escorts and ships of war that needed to be refueled. So that's why they commandeered them, see, so that they could be on hand. And there was quite a lot of Empire ships that were commandeered by the Navy for use in wartime. a lot of them.
Would the fact that it had been commandeered by the Navy make any impact on you?
Oh, no, 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 no. Not really. Because, you see, all the merchant ships, as the war went on, they had... Sometimes they had naval personnel on board. Sometimes they had army personnel for firing the guns. These Oerlikon machine guns and quite a lot of... They were very modern anti-aircraft guns, mostly. And that we had soldiers whose job was specifically to fire these guns. So it didn't affect us, you see. We had nothing to do with them. But that Empire Diplomat and all the ships after that had were full of guns of different kinds for self-defence, you know. And so that's why they had extra crew, sometimes Navy, sometimes Army personnel, just to fire the guns.
How did that system work out?
Oh, well, we never saw them being used. I was never on a ship that fired guns, really, apart from practice, a little bit of practice that they had. But the guns were never used. I was never in a theatre of war that needed to fire guns. So,
how do you feel now about having served in the Merchant Navy in the war?
Oh, well, to me, when I think of my time as a cook and a fireman on the herring drifters and being an officer on board ship, well, I was like a king in a palace compared with my working on a herring drifter. I enjoyed it tremendously. And, of course, everybody had a share of wartime experiences, but that's part and parcel of life. And I enjoyed my time in the Merchant Service. I really did. To be able to see different parts of the world, well, it was wonderful. It was terrific. And I was paid to do so. I think that was really good. No, I enjoyed my time at sea. I was over 6 years at sea in the Merchant Service. And during my time at sea, after I got my second class PMG, that was a measure of security for me after the war. But after a while, I began to be interested in other things. I was given a novel to read for Christmas 1944. It was from that lady, American lady friend that I'd met in New York. And this novel was called The Robe by Lloyd C. Douglas. It was a Christian novel, and the story of Christ was in it. And from that time onwards, I began to be interested in Christianity. I felt that it's something I really wanted to know and understand for myself. And so it was that I began to read different kinds of books. For instance, when I was in St. John's, Newfoundland, two things I remember about St. John's. One was Signal Hill. That was where Marconi first received a signal from Land's End, Paul Doe. The first time that a message was sent across the Atlantic, Marconi received it from a kite aerial up in Signal Hill in St. John, Newfoundland. The other thing I was interested in was there was a Christian bookshop there, and I wanted to buy A Life of Christ. And I remember spending a morning, part of an afternoon, and the one that I bought was called The Life of Jesus by Ernest Renan. And this was a book that I bought. Renan was a Frenchman, and I could tell from the book he was neither a Protestant nor a Catholic. Well, what was he? Well, he didn't believe in miracles, he believed that Jesus was a man. But the book itself was very comprehensive, and I thought, well, I could use this as a study about the life of Christ from the Bible. So, anyway, when I was home on leave, I was a member of the Portessie Methodist Church. When I was home, I always went to church on a Sunday, morning and evening. And one Sunday morning, on the 9th of September, 1945, the minister, the Reverend John Stewart, was preaching from the text, Matthew chapter 16, verse 15, "Whom say ye that I am?" And Peter replied, "Thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God." And that Sunday morning, I'd been reading about this matter, about Christ and the Gospels. And that Sunday morning, although I didn't understand all about it, I said something after this fashion: "Yes, I believe that Christ was the Son of God. I believe he came to be my Saviour. I'm going to follow him. I'm going to serve him for the rest of my days." And that's what I've been doing since. So that was really I wouldn't call it my conversion, but there was a change took place in my life, whereby instead of being interested in wireless, continuing as a wireless operator, after the war, through my home minister, I went to Cliff College, a Methodist training college near Sheffield, and I began to study for what you might call Christian service. And then, when I finished my time at Cliff College, I became a Methodist lay pastor, and then I joined the London City Mission, and I was 20 years a missionary in London. So that was after the war, of course, and that's what I did after the war. And then after I'd been 18 years in the London City Mission, I became a port missionary with the British Sailors Society. And I was 2 years in London, and while I was in London, it fell to my lot to lay a wreath on the war memorial for merchant seamen at the Sunken Gardens at Tower Hill. And so when I was laying that wreath one November, Remembrance Sunday, I'm not giving a lot for this pomp and ceremony, but I couldn't but help think of the two men, Fricker and Smith, who were blown up on the Ball Trader when I laid that wreath on the Sunken Garden, the War Memorial at Tower Hill. That was in the 1960s, 1968 or 69, and it fell to my lot to do that. So that's a continuation of my wartime memories, as you might say.